Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1095, The Destabilization of China, Part 6, Asian Deep Politics. This is being recorded on October 29th of the year 2019. The entire question of what is going on vis-a-vis China is a deep one and an important one, and I'm going to have to do probably at least one future program, but there are so many other things that we're going to get to. It is interesting to see this whole thing placed in a Cold War context, and indeed our media are into deep Cold War mode, and we're being told, you know, the communist Chinese and blah, 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 blah. China is the largest market in the world, and the trade war between Team Trump and China is throwing turmoil into not only global capital markets, but many individual industries and consumers in this country and elsewhere, who, particularly people in the working and lower middle class, who need to buy goods that are made in China precisely because of the cheap labor and the fact that corporations have moved there. The complexity and the alarm that I think this should generate, because I think there is a strong chance that this will result in a third world war, is something that we will have to tackle in a future program. However, in assessing what is going on, I think it is important to understand some of the deep politics vis-a-vis Asia, because these are things that have not only borne directly on the ascent of communism in China in the immediate aftermath of World War II, they bear directly on things going on before World War II, things going on during World War II, and the historical memory in China of many of these things, including and especially the politics of the dope trade, are something that is going to affect the transigence or lack thereof on the part of the Chinese government. In our last program, we concluded with an article from Rolling Stone magazine of February 14th of 2013 by Matt Taibbi, and it was about the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, or HSBC. That was a bank that grew powerful in China. It was a British bank that obviously had strong links to Hong Kong, and much of its growth in the middle and late 19th century came from banking the profits from the Chinese opium traffic. Britain forced opium on the Chinese in order to correct a trade imbalance, and that imperial episode is very much in the forefront of Chinese political consciousness. We also noted HSBC had been a bank that catered to jihadist finance, including Al-Qaeda, and it remains to be determined whether there is perhaps an HSBC link to Al-Qaeda / Muslim Brotherhood / Pan-Turkist / Uyghur activity in the petroleum and natural resource-rich Xinjiang province. That is something to keep in mind. And perhaps we will revisit that Rolling Stone article if time permits. I don't think it is going to. However, in assessing not only the political forces that have impelled the U.S. and the West in the direction it is going, but also some of the things that are front and center in the Chinese political consciousness, I think, bear review. In particular, some of the events in and around the subject material of the landmark book Gold Warriors by Sperling and Peggy Seagrave, Bear Investigation. I have done many programs about that. The book Gold Warriors is one of those books that is a must-read. It is like Surveillance Valley that I did a recent series about. It is as important as any book I have ever read. I would not say it is the most important book, but it is one of those important books. And beyond that, the politics underlying the destabilization of China go to the politics around the Earth Island, things having to do with Ukraine. We're going to come back to that. Things having to do with the Intermarium. That was an anti-Soviet and anti-Russian intelligence alliance, overlapping the Promethean League and put together by a Polish dictator Pilsudski in the early 20th century. Some of the things going on in Ukraine and in the Intermarium and in the Earth Island also will bear on Yaquism, a manifestation of fascism that is complex and to the average American political palate might appear incomprehensible. Another one of those must-read books is Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaqui and the Post-War Fascist International by Kevin Coogan. We will certainly mention that. It is a tough read, 600-plus pages, but looming as a possibility, particularly if Putin, he certainly is going to give way to someone, but if ultimately a powerful fascist milieu in Russia comes to power, we may see a fascist Europe, including a fascist Russia, united against the U.S., which is something to contemplate. That would appear to be, I think, almost incomprehensible to people in this country, including people in the corridors of power. But that is another subject. One of the things to bear in mind is, again, the history of narcotics trafficking vis-a-vis China. And what we're going to talk about first is not only the profound role of narcotics trafficking in the Kuomintang of Chiang Kai-shek, but also the alliance between Chiang Kai-shek and the Japanese in Manchuria, their cooperation vis-a-vis the narcotics traffic, and the sanctuary or the alliance that Chiang Kai-shek had with powerful political forces in this country. We're going to read an excerpt from the book The CIA as Organized Crime by Douglas Valentine. This is published in softcover by the Clarity Press, C-L-A-R-I-T-Y, and copyrighted 2017. Douglas Valentine is a very important writer. He wrote the definitive book about the Phoenix Program in Vietnam, and also a masterful two-part series about the drug traffic, The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack. And again, from the CIA as Organized Crime, about the links between Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang party and the narcotics traffic, something we spoke about, by the way, in AFA program number 24, and the links between Chiang Kai-shek and the Japanese, and also with right-wing political forces, very powerful right-wing political forces in the U.S. We read, in the 1920s, the U.S. threw its weight behind Chiang Kai-shek, whose Kuomintang party was fighting the communist Chinese and several other warlords for control of China. The U.S. was competing with the other colonial nations for control of China, which had a cheap labor force and represented billions in profits for U.S. corporations and investors. The problem was that the Kuomintang supported itself through the opium trade. It's well documented in the diplomatic cables between the U.S. government and its representatives in China. Historians Kinder, K-I-N-D-E-R, and Walker, W-A-L-K-E-R, said the commissioner of the Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, quote, clearly knew about the ties between Chang and opium dealers. Anslinger knew that Shanghai was, quote, the prime producer and exporter to the illicit world drug markets, unquote, through a syndicate controlled by Tu Yuexing, a crime lord who facilitated Chang's bloody ascent to power in 1927. Again, we spoke about this in AFA 24. As early as 1932, Anslinger knew that Chang's finance minister was Du's protector. He'd had evidence since 1929 that American Tongs were receiving Kuomintang narcotics and distributing it to the mafia. Middlemen worked with opium merchants, gangsters like Du, Japanese occupation forces in Manchuria, and Dr. Lansing, L-A-N-S-I-N-G, Ling, L-I-N-G, quote, who supplied narcotics to Chinese officials traveling abroad, unquote. In 1938, Chiang Kai-shek appointed Dr. Ling head of his narcotic control department. In October of 1934, the Treasury attaché in Shanghai, quote, submitted reports implicating Chiang Kai-shek in the heroin trade to North America, unquote. In 1935, the attaché reported that the superintendent of maritime customs in Shanghai was acting as agent for Chiang Kai-shek in arranging for the preparation and shipment of the stuff to the United States. These reports reached Anslinger's desk, so he knew which Kuomintang officials and trade missions were delivering dope to American Tongs and which American mafia drug rings were buying it. He knew the Tongs were kicking back a percentage of the profits to finance Chang's regime. After Japanese forces seized Shanghai in August of 1937, Anslinger was even less willing to deal honestly with the situation. By then, Du was sitting on Shanghai's municipal board with William J. Keswick, K-E-S-W-I-C-K. Du found sanctuary in Hong Kong, where he was welcomed by a cabal of free-trading British colonialists whose shipping and banking companies earned huge revenues by allowing Du to push his drugs on the hapless Chinese. These last few sentences again, because this is not only part of the deep politics of China and its relationship with the U.S. and the West, but Hong Kong in particular. After Japanese forces seized Shanghai in August of 1937, Anslinger was even less willing to deal honestly with the situation. By then, Tu Yuexing was sitting on Shanghai's municipal board with William J. Keswick. Tu found sanctuary in Hong Kong, where he was welcomed by a cabal of free-trading British colonialists whose shipping and banking companies earned huge revenues by allowing Tu to push his drugs on the hapless Chinese. The revenues were truly immense. According to Colonel Joseph Stilwell, later, by the way, General Joseph Stilwell, who was the main U.S. military liaison to Chiang Kai-shek, whom he termed basically the peanut and said the only difference between Chiang Kai-shek and Mussolini was that Mussolini was much better at it than Chiang Kai-shek. Ultimately, Stilwell was replaced with General Albert Cody Wiedemeyer, who was not only educated in part at the German Kriegswehr Academy, their equivalent of West Point, but he rented his apartment from the number two man in the SA, the German Sturmabteilung, the Brown Shirts, and was fingered by many observers as having deliberately leaked the Rainbow Five military mobilization plan for the U.S. in World War II to sympathetic right-wing media forces in the U.S. We talked about that in AFA program number 11. One more time. Du found sanctuary in Hong Kong, where he was welcomed by a cabal of free-trading British colonialists whose shipping and banking companies earned huge revenues by allowing Du to push his drugs on the hapless Chinese. The revenues were truly immense. According to Colonel Joseph Stilwell, the U.S. military attaché in China in 1935, there were, quote, 8 million Chinese heroin and morphine addicts and another 72 million Chinese opium addicts, unquote. Anslinger tried to minimize the problem by lying and saying that Americans were not affected. But the final decisions were made by his bosses in Washington, and from their national security perspective, the profits enabled the Kuomintang to purchase $31 million worth of fighter planes from arms dealer William Pauley to fight the communists, and that trumped any moral dilemmas about trading with the Japanese or getting Americans addicted. It's all documented. Check the sources I cite in my books. Plus, U.S. congressmen and senators in the China lobby were profiting from its guns for drugs for business, too. They got kickbacks in the form of campaign funds. In exchange, they looked away as long as Anslinger told them the dope stayed overseas. After 1949, the China lobby manipulated public hearings, and Anslinger cooked the books to make sure that the People's Republic was blamed for all narcotics coming out of the far west. Everyone made money, and after 1947, the operation was run out of Taiwan with CIA assistance. The U.S. government's involvement in the illicit drug business was institutionalized during World War II. While serving on General Joseph Stilwell's staff in 1944, Foreign Service Officer John Service, S-E-R-V-I-C-E, reported from Kunming, the city where the Flying Tigers and OSS were headquartered, that the Nationalists were totally dependent on opium and, quote, incapable of solving China's problems, unquote. Service's reports contributed to the Truman administration's decision not to come to Chiang Kai-shek's rescue at the end of the war. In retaliation, Chiang's intelligence chief, Tai Li, parenthetically known as the Himmler of China, had his agents in America accused Service of leaking the Kuomintang's battle plans to a leftist newspaper. Service was arrested. After Service was cleared of any wrongdoing, the China lobby persisted in attacking his character for the next 6 years. He was subjected to 8 loyalty hearings and dismissed from the State Department in 1951. Service's persecution was fair warning that anyone linking the Nationalists Chinese to drug smuggling would, at a minimum, be branded a communist sympathizer and his reputation ruined. That is how the U.S. drug problem is still protected today, although security for the operation has improved and whistleblowers are smeared in other ways. Witness, by the way, what happened to Gary Webb. After World War II, the business of managing the government's involvement in the illicit narcotics trade was given to the CIA because it could covertly conduct support operations for, among others, the Nationalist Chinese in Taiwan. The CIA also relocated and supplied one of Chiang's armies in Burma. This Kuomintang army supported itself through the opium trade, and the CIA flew the opium to places where it was converted to heroin and sold to the mafia. The other bureaucracies, the military, and the Departments of State Justice, and Treasury, provided protection along with the China lobby congressmen and senators who controlled the information. And again, the imperial relationship between the Kuomintang, who were fighting against originally Mao Zedong's forces, which ultimately gave rise to the contemporary Chinese Communist Party, is an historical memory that is very, very deep in China. There appears to be, and perhaps we'll finish up an article from Consortium News about what's going on in China. There certainly appears to be an awareness on the part of the People's Republic of China and its Communist Party that they will ultimately have to answer to their people. There are also some indications that they are doing that. Contemporary American journalistic coverage notwithstanding, it remains to be seen whether the full court press strategy will result in the disintegration of China, or at least the partial physical carving up of China with Tibet and the SS-allied forces of the Dalai Lama. And again, there is a strong historical link there, as we have spoken about in For the Record 547, among other shows. The possible secession of Xinjiang province, rich in petroleum and other mineral resources, which we have spoken about in 549, 550, and other shows, including, For the Record, 792 and 793. Actually, I should say, 793 and 794. It remains to be seen if that in fact happens. If Hong Kong were to successfully secede from China, it would not be surprising to see that become once again an epicenter of the narcotics traffic. It is today an epicenter of white-collar crime. I also suspect that electronic intelligence and other intelligence to be directed against China will have an epicenter in Hong Kong. Again, it remains to be seen what will happen. We have spoken about some of these things in past programs. I recommend in particular AFA program number 11 and AFA program number 24 for background on this. Something to be noted here again is the historical memory of what the drug traffic did to China. It was imposed on China by Britain in the Opium Wars. We touched on that briefly in the Matt Taibbi article from the from February of 2013. And again, the central role of the narcotics traffic to the Kuomintang and nationalist regime of Chiang Kai-shek is something that is largely unknown in the U.S. and yet is very well known in China. It was known quite well, obviously, to some Americans who were involved with China in the Second World War. Something, too, that not only impacts China, but the U.S. as a whole, and that concerns the role of the Japanese in the Second World War, not only their involvement with the nationalist Chinese in the narcotics traffic, but the reinstitution of the same fascist elements in Japan after World War II, something we went into in, among other programs, For the Record 905, and the fundamental role of the looted gold and jewel wealth of Asia that occurred under the Golden Lily program, and which is a fundamental element of post-World War II financial and political doings that we have spoken about in many programs that we have done about the book Gold Warriors with Peggy M. Sterling Seagrave, just off the top of my head, For the Record 428, For the Record 446, 454, 506 and 509, as well as For the Record 688 and 689, just some of the many programs. I will have links to those in the written description for this broadcast.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
There is a very good review of the book Gold Warriors by the very same Douglas Valentine whose work we had excerpted in the article or in the excerpt, the first element of discussion and reading in this program. This is from Counterpunch magazine of September 25th of 2003. It is simply titled Gold Warriors by Douglas Valentine. And he talks about many of the important aspects of the book. I would, again, refer listeners to the many programs I have done about that and to the book itself. This is one of the as important a book as I have ever read, and I think an understanding of this is fundamental to a serious grasp of what is taking place today. From this Counterpunch review of Gold Warriors of September 25th of 2003, again by the estimable Douglas Valentine. Gold Warriors is more than a book about Japan's serious, sober, and deliberate, unquote, plundering of Asia's treasure from 1895 until 1945, and its collusion after the war with American officials to recover and use the loot as a secret political action slush fund to promote right-wing regimes. Gold Warriors, America's secret recovery of Yamashita's gold, is a journey into the darkest recesses of history and the human soul. Authors Peggy and Sterling Seagrave not only unravel one of the greatest crimes and cover-ups ever, they reveal something new and startling about the depths of human depravity and barbarity and the human capacity for deceit. The book begins in 1895 with a fascinating account of the grisly assassination of Korea's Queen Min by terrorists posing as business agents of Japanese companies. The clever coup d'etat provides Japan with official deniability, and the confusion that follows provides the Japanese with a pretext for its military occupation and plundering of Korea. Japan's brutal conquest of Korea foretells how it will achieve one victory after another in Far East Asia over the ensuing 45 years. The next victory occurs in 1904, when tiny Japan defeats Russia and annexes southern Manchuria. Manchuria, unlike Korea, has little gold worth stealing, but it is rich in natural resources, so the Japanese settle in for the long haul and slowly develop Manchuria over several decades. They build roads and create industries, and more importantly, they work with corrupt warlords and Chinese gangsters associated with Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang Party to transform Manchuria into a vast poppy field. By 1937, the Japanese and their gangster and Kuomintang associates are responsible for 90% of the world's illicit narcotics. They turn Manchu Emperor Puyi into an addict and open thousands of opium dens as a way of suppressing the Chinese. When subversion and propaganda don't get the job done, they commit unspeakable atrocities. In late 1937 and early 1938, the Japanese slaughter an estimated 350,000 Chinese civilians and prisoners of war in Nanking. Tens of thousands of women and girls are raped and many are mutilated or murdered. Nanking foretells what will happen to Japan, what will happen as Japan expands its empire to include Indochina, Malaysia, Taiwan, and the Philippines. It's also with the Rape of Nanking that the authors introduce the main characters in the book, the Japanese soldiers, crime lords, and officials who, by the December 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, realize they have bitten off more than they can chew and begin their retreat to Japan. A small inner circle becomes responsible for securing billions of dollars worth of gold, platinum, and cultural artifacts, and precious gems stolen over the previous 45 years. The Japanese call this Operation Golden Lily, and the Seagraves do not shy away from naming those involved. They finger General Dohara, Do-Ihara, D-O-I-H-A-R-A, and Japan's top Yakuza gangster, Kodama Yoshio, both of whom worked closely with Chinese drug smugglers in Manchuria and Shanghai. Kodama Yoshio, by the way, eventually became the CIA's main man in Japan, and also became a key official with the early Unification Church. Continuing. Golden Lily's overall boss is Prince Chichibu, C-H-I-C-H-I-B-U, one of Emperor Hirohito's three brothers. The Kempei Tai, the Japanese Secret Service, were Golden Lily's first agents, moving 6,000 metric tons of gold from Nanking to Japan in 1938. But most of the Golden Lily treasure was buried in the Philippines by General Yamashita, and it is in the Philippines that most of the action in the book takes place. When the Seagraves claim that their lives are in danger for having written this book, they aren't kidding. This is explosive material, for they not only name the Japanese involved in Golden Lily, they name the Japanese corporations, including Nissan, Mitsui, which processed Manchurian opium into heroin in the 1930s, Mitsubishi, and Sumitomo, as having used American POWs as slave laborers during the war. They also named the Americans who worked with the Japanese to recover the buried loot after World War II. The Japanese had no monopoly on deceit or disregard for human suffering, and some of these Americans conspired with the Japanese to deny reparations to the POWs, sex slaves, and forced laborers that survived. The reader will learn how, in order to share in the plunder, members of General Douglas MacArthur's occupation army, along with the U.S. government officials and banks, connived to absolve Japanese corporations, war criminals, and drug smugglers, many prominent officials in the post-war government, of responsibility for these ghastly crimes. How the Americans went about this is very interesting. To ensure his silence, General Yamashita was hanged by a military tribunal in February of 1946, while his right-hand man, Kojima, K-O-J-I-M-A, was tortured by a Filipino, Santo Romama, S-A-N-T-A-R-O-M-A-M-A, into revealing where the treasure vaults were buried in the Philippines. Romama then guided CIA officer Edward Lansdale to the loot. Lansdale did a quick inventory and for the next 20 years supervised Romama, the unlikely frontman for a number of slush funds. Thereafter, the purloined gold was moved to 176 accounts in 42 banks in Western countries to people and organizations the CIA wanted to secretly support. The Americans viewed this money as a war prize, and every American president from Harry Truman to George W. Bush has used the slush funds for various purposes. Truman through a number of his top aides close to the Harrimans and the Rockefellers, set up the Black Eagle Trust Fund to fight communism. General MacArthur set up the Yatsuya Fund to finance Japan's Yakuza underworld, and one of his aides set up the M Fund to help reconstruct Japan and turn it into an economic powerhouse. And by the way, as I saw, and for the record, 446, also to finance the furtherance of the Unit 731 biological warfare program, including General Ishii, who had conducted extensive biological warfare attacks on the Chinese in World War II, to basically shift venues. The files of Unit 731 and General Ishii himself then collaborated with the U.S. in the Cold War period. This is some of the deep politics here that were unknown to the vast majority of Americans, but very well known to the Chinese. There are parts of China today that still suffer from some of the biological agents used by the Japanese in World War II. One more time. Resuming where we left off. Eisenhower used that N Fund to help create Japan's Liberal Democratic Party in 1956, and in 1960, Vice President Richard Nixon turned over the N Fund to Japan's Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi in return for kickbacks Nixon used to help finance his presidential campaign. Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and both Bushes were complicit, using Golden Lily slush fund money to buy elections in nations all around the world. George W. got into the act in March of 2001, sending Navy SEAL commandos to the Philippines to recover a portion of General Yamashita's gold. Bush was privately in the market to buy some of the bullion that was being recovered. His representative was William Stance Farish, his nominee as ambassador to Great Britain, and the manager of his blind trust. Most of the action in the book takes place in the Philippines, where the Japanese buried much of the Golden Lily loot in 175 vaults in and around Manila. Prince Takeda Tsuneyoshi, using the nom de guerre Kimshu, was in charge in northern Luzon and gave maps to his Filipino aide, Ben, indicating where the vaults were located. Kimshu swore Ben to secrecy, but gradually the maps slipped out, and in 1971, a treasure hunter named Rojas unearthed several gold bars and a golden Buddha that, amazingly, weighed a ton. Word of the discovery reached Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, and soon thereafter, Rojas was arrested, tortured, and imprisoned, and Marcos acquired the Golden Buddha. Marcos, notably, had been working with the CIA for years using Golden Lily assets to bribe nations to support the Vietnam War. In return for services rendered, Marcos was allowed to sell over $1 trillion in gold through Australian brokers. By the 1970s, rumors about General Yamashita's gold had grabbed the imagination of a number of treasure hunters, and in 1975, Robert Curtis acquired copies of Kimshu's maps. Financed by far-right-wing John Birch Society and working with cutthroat Ferdinand Marcos, Curtis joined with Ben and Japan's Lord Ichiwara to find the remainder of the loot. Alas, the partners were mutually untrustworthy, and Curtis, like Rojas, ran into trouble. But the dangers of hunting for buried Japanese gold in the Philippines did not dissuade others, and in the mid-1980s, a group of disgruntled former CIA officers and military men, including Generals John Singlaub and Robert Schweitzer, organized an expedition using former Navy SEALs and Army forces Army Special Forces personnel. One member of the team, Charles McDougall, actually recovered 325 metric tons of gold in 1987, although, as one might suspect, he found himself in trouble too. The Seagraves conclude their exciting and excellent book by taking us down the money trail and explaining in layman's terms how the gold warriors had been able to cover their tracks. Emperor Hirohito, for example, worked directly with Pope Pius XII to launder money through the Vatican Bank. In another instance, Japan's Ministry of Finance produced gold certificates that were slightly different from ordinary Japanese bonds. The Seagraves interviewed persons defrauded in this scam and other scams involving the Union Bank of Switzerland and Citibank. Without descending into convoluted legalese, the Seagraves described the devious means bankers had used to conceal the vast hoards of Nazi and Japanese gold in their possession. The Seagraves do this primarily by examining multi-million-dollar lawsuits filed by Rojas, Curtis, and Santa Romana's heirs against Citibank, the U.S. government, and Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos. In this way, the Seagraves reveal how the banks use complex accounting methods or claim the gold certificates are fake, or simply move gold to offshore accounts to conceal it. In every case, the U.S. government assists the banks by stonewalling, refusing to investigate, or ignoring Freedom of Information Act requests. In one noteworthy case, Attorney W.R. Cotton Jones, by the way, we spoke about this in For the Record 688. In one noteworthy case, Attorney W.R. Cotton Jones walked into the Swiss Bank Corporation in New York City and asked the bank to authenticate a $25 million certificate of deposit issued by the bank and bearing the Federal Reserve seal. Cotton was quickly arrested by the Secret Service, and his certificates were confiscated. As Cotton rhetorically asks, how can a Swiss bank have a U.S. federal agency intervene on its behalf and confiscate personal possessions? What right does the Secret Service have to arrest, interrogate, intimidate, and threaten anyone on a Swiss bank's behalf without due process of law? The answer is obvious. The banks that maintain U.S. government's stolen gold are above the law, and if they stonewall long enough, anyone trying to sue them will eventually fade away. The Seagraves asked the Treasury Department, Defense Department, and the CIA for records on Yamashita's gold in 1987, but were told the records were exempt from release. During the 1990s, the records mysteriously went missing. Other records were destroyed in what the Seagraves caustically call history laundering, unquote. Throughout the book, the writing is descriptive and engaging. Having authored several books about the Far East, the Seagraves are experts in their field, and their arguments are convincing. In fact, they have compiled so much supporting evidence that many of the documents are contained on companion CDs the reader can buy separately at the Seagraves website. There are two CDs, the first containing 11 files. This writer examined three of them on Lansdale, Kadama, and Golden Lily, and found them utterly fascinating. The second CD contains 19 files, many concerning the various lawsuits the Seagraves have used as evidence to prove their case. And they do more then prove their case. In the end, Gold Warriors transcends its subject matter, and its great triumph is that it tells us something new about the savage and avaricious side of human nature. The reader will walk away from the book astounded and outraged at the immensity of the fraudulent activities that the world's governments, banks, and spies are engaged in. Gold Warriors is chilling in its accumulation. Well, it is indeed. And not only the complicity between the Japanese and Chiang Kai-shek, but the aforementioned in the excerpt from the CIA's organized crime that we read, the complicity between Chiang Kai-shek and the narcotics traffic and the U.S.-China lobby, these are things that, again, are largely unknown to Americans, but are very much in the Chinese political and historical awareness. Indeed, as we looked at in that article by Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone, the opium wars in the mid-19th century, which imposed the opium traffic on the Chinese, and then Colonel Joseph Stilwell, who was the American military attaché to China, estimated in the late 30s that there were 8 million Chinese morphine and heroin addicts and another 72 million addicted to opium. That addict community having supplied much of the capital, not only to the Kuomintang as a political entity, but the Green Gang of the aforementioned Chu Yuesheng from Shanghai, who found refuge in Hong Kong, not incidentally, was one of the major elements of lethal muscle that was used by Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence and interior minister Tai Li, known as the Himmler of China, or sometimes the Himmler of Asia. The role of the narcotics traffic, in which both elements of the U.S. and the Japanese were complicit, is well known in China. Also, with tens of millions of Chinese having been killed in World War II, including many who died in the biological warfare attacks by Unit 731, whose files and some of whose personnel were incorporated into the U.S. and Fort Detrick during the Cold War, is again something that is an historical memory very much present in China at this time.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Something that I noted in an article from Consortium News from August 19th of 2019, U.S. backs xenophobia and mob violence in Hong Kong by Dan Cohen from The Gray Zone. There was an interesting bit of graffiti that cropped up in the activities in Hong Kong. In July, protesters vandalized the Hong Kong liaison office, spray-painting the word China, quote, capital S-H-I-N-A, on its facade. The term is a xenophobic slur, some in Hong Kong and Taiwan used to refer to mainland China. The anti-Chinese phenomenon was visible during the 2014 Umbrella Movement protests, as well with signs plastered around the city reading, Hong Kong for Hong Kongers. What is explained in a link that is included in this article, which is linked to the written description both for this show and for the record show 792, and that is that the genesis of the term Shina, which is the equivalent of, quote, chink, unquote, in English, is with the, it arose during the Sino-Japanese War. That is the conflict between China and Japan that began in 1931 and that continued in the 1930s and then became part of what we call the Second World War. The use of that racist term, one with its genesis in the Sino-Japanese War, is not only noteworthy in and of itself and speaks volumes, I think, about the nature of many elements of the protesters in Hong Kong, but it's something that certainly, I think, has to be considered as deliberately provocative in some of their discussion of what is going on in Hong Kong. The government of China has maintained accurately, in my opinion, that what is taking place is something akin to the color revolutions. And one of the things that appears to be going on is an attempt at provoking the Chinese authorities and ultimately perhaps the People's Liberation Army itself from intervening and committing violence against the protesters, which will then serve to feed the propaganda mills of the West. I think, again, in this context, that the protesters in Hong Kong are using the word Shina, which, again, has it's the equivalent of chink in English, and it has its genesis with the Sino-Japanese War. That is noteworthy here and something which I think is gauged to aggravate and to provoke the Chinese political and historical awareness. Something that we spoke about in For the Record program number 11 is not only the China lobby, the aforementioned fascist sympathizing General Albert Kobe Wiedemeyer, who was appointed to be the American liaison to Chiang Kai-shek after General Joseph Stilwell characterized Chiang Kai-shek as basically a Chinese Mussolini. We also spoke about the fact that the the nationalist Chinese chief of intelligence in 1943 was a guy named Louis Siefkin, who was actually a German Gestapo agent who had provided key intelligence to the Japanese for their attack on Pearl Harbor. It is also in the context of the maneuvering between the U.S. and the nationalist Chinese and in the late World War II and immediate post-World War II period that we see the genesis of the John Birch Society. John Birch, as we looked at in AFA Program 11, and as we came back to in our series about socialists for Trump and Hitler, John Birch was an OSS agent assigned as the intelligence liaison to General Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers in World War II. He then was in a mission within a week of VJ Day to recruit Japanese puppet troops, Chinese puppet troops who had fought with the Japanese to fight against the Chinese communists on behalf of the nationalist Chinese. And that is where he was killed. And that he was termed the first casualty of World War III. And I think it is worth noting not only that the John Birch Society is experiencing a resurgence, but that the China lobby that was spoken about both in the, well, particularly in the excerpt from the Valentine book, The CIA as Organized Crime, was basically involved with pinning the blame for the ascent of communism in China on a fifth column in the U.S., and they were responsible for pillorying members of the U.S. State Department, like the aforementioned John Service, who was spoken about in the Valentine text, as somehow communist dupes and collaborators. These were people who saw Chiang Kai-shek and what he was for what he was, and said accurately that he could not solve China's problems. And furthermore, because of his collaboration with the Japanese and with his fundamental involvement with the narcotics traffic that victimized millions, tens of millions of Chinese, Chiang Kai-shek was despised by many people in China. The pillorying of the State Department with regard to China was one of the major focal points of Joe McCarthy's hearings, and I think we should note that Joe McCarthy's right-hand man, the late Attorney Roy Cohn, was not only very close to Donald Trump, but was in many ways a political mentor to Donald Trump. And I think regarding Donald Trump's policy vis-a-vis China and the historical role of Joe McCarthy and the China lobby in purging the State Department of reliable officers who were in the position to give an accurate picture of Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang is something to keep in mind. Again, the deep scars and the historical awareness in China of what was done to China by the Japanese was related then to something else that we spoke about in AFA program number 11. I will recap this here. From the book The Nightmare Decade, The Life and Times of Senator Joe McCarthy by Fred Cook, which goes into, by the way, the purge of the State Department expertise on China. When the war ended, China was in utter chaos. Thousands of Japanese troops wandered around the countryside fully armed, with no one accepting their surrender. John F. Melby, a State Department officer, in a day-to-day diary he kept at the time, reflected in bewilderment upon this anomaly. On December 27, 1945, he noted, quote, "I still don't understand about the Japanese. Officially, they are being disarmed. But the fact is, they never seem to be. In Shanghai, 15,000 Japanese troops still walk the streets with full equipment. In Nanking, the high-rank Japanese generals are bosom buddies of the Chinese. In the north, tens of thousands of Japanese soldiers are used to guard railroads and warehouses and to fight the communists. If you ask what this is all about, the answer is either a denial or, in more candid moments, a shh, we don't talk about that." In another entry on January 30th, 1947, a good 16 months after VJJ, Moby noted that though it was being kept very quiet, unquote, there were, again quoting, 80,000 holdout Japanese troops in eastern and northwestern Manchuria who are fully equipped fighting the communists, unquote. And again, the historical and political memory of this in China is very powerful and no doubt is very much on the minds of the Chinese political leadership. This is not to say that China doesn't have huge problems. They are effed in many important ways. They also are making enormous progress in other ways. They also are a major nuclear power, and it remains to be seen how the full-court press strategy plays out vis-a-vis China. But my belief is if it does not work out as the West wants, there is very likely to be a Third World War, and that will end our civilization. This, however, ends this particular program. This is the conclusion of For the Record program number 1095, The Destabilization of China and Asian Deep Politics. This is being recorded on October 29th of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.